Spouse abuse is a difficult topic to talk about. It is, last week Frank got to talk about the roles of the husband and the roles of the wife in marriage, and it leads directly to this, and that work that he did last week, if you remember that, will be helpful when you deal with couples who are coming to you with a spouse abuse problem. What may happen is you may have someone come into your counseling room and they've mentioned to you that, I think we had listed Julie and Jay here, but they come into your counseling room, they've told you to have a marital problem, and you've been through the counseling and you're feeling pretty good about this. And they come and they sit across the desk and you ask a few questions, and as you get started, she says, the real problem is that he beats me. And this is not what your preparation for marriage counseling did not include this script. Right? You're thinking, wait. But biblical counseling is biblical counseling. And the Bible provides answers for even more difficult problems than the ones you were hoping were going to show up in your office. And so we don't want you to get panicky. We don't want you to think, oh no, I'm not prepared for this. But I do want to tell you, this is a tough subject. And some of you may see this very differently than what we teach. And we're certainly open to discuss that with you. So what do? Do you send them to, you tell her she should get up and leave and go to the local women's shelter? Or do you help them find an attorney? Do you decide whether you can counsel them together or counsel them apart? Where are you going to go to get the expertise that you need to help these people? And how can you use the church? How can it be enlisted to help in the process? Spouse abuse is gaining great notoriety today, and it has been for probably increasingly for the last 10 or 15 years. Some statistics are that every 15 seconds in the United States, some woman is beaten. Over 4,000 are killed annually by a partner. It's estimated that annually between 2 million and 6 million women are abused. I want to tell you to be careful with statistics. Oftentimes they are, no doubt, the surveys no doubt are composed of samples of people that are primarily unregenerate. So those may be skewed from what you're going to run into in your counseling at your church. When you look out at the congregation, you shouldn't assume that one out of four or even one out of three women there is being abused, but you should be aware that there is a good possibility there are people in your congregation who are facing this. It is a problem the church has to face because there are those who bring with them their former ways of handling life and handling stress. You also have to remember the statistics, even the ones I read to you tonight, can be distorted or exaggerated. Sometimes people use them for political reasons, for ideological reasons, to move money in certain places, to get certain services developed. So you always have to look at statistics carefully. But this is a problem that transcends all racial, social, and economic boundaries. But that really shouldn't be a surprise to any of you or any of us, because sin transcends all racial, social, and economic boundaries. And we're talking about another sinful behavior here. So we are not exempt. I know in our church, we're all still sinners. I assume in your church, you are still sinners too. So don't be lulled into thinking that this couldn't happen in your church. But the real issue becomes the couple standing in front of you are not interested in statistics. You have someone who is hurting in front of you, and a couple that really needs help. A lot of options people are going to offer. Some people are going to say there's no hope. You ought to just leave him. If his pattern is to be abusive, get out and get out now. Some people are going to say that he has to just get tough and get that situation under control. And some people are going to say, just let go of the whole thing and let God take charge. And although we know God has to take charge, sometimes he requires us to do things in the process, not just to let go. So we want to get a biblical framework in hand that will be useful for helping hurting people in a way that will exalt Christ and will honor God. So we're going to start by looking at a profile of an abuser and a person who's being abused, a victim. Word of caution, these are tentative descriptions, and they're really drawn more from experience of people who are doing counseling, and sometimes even from secular people, psychologists, whatever. So it's just a profile, it's not an exact picture of who it is. And just because somebody doesn't fit this profile doesn't mean they're not an abuser. So we're going to say that the abuser, first of all, attempts strict control and domination. They normally seek to keep the family isolated because that adds to their control. The husbands, which is what we see most often, the husbands react to their wife's successes in a very jealous fashion. And that would be success at work, success in relationships, success in making friends. They're very jealous, very protective. These men tend to be very competitive. They're men who, if you pass them, they're probably going to speed up. And they're competitive people. They got to be in control. They got to be winning. They learn to control and manipulate, and they do so whenever they're not the center of attention. So there might be family gatherings and family parties, and they tend to act out around those to get the attention drawn to them. The second characteristic is that they tend to blame others for their problems. They find that violence, therefore, is an acceptable way to gain power over people. They have a very low tolerance of stress. When situations get stressful for them, they're going to resort to a violent way of controlling that situation to lower their stress. They minimize, they deny, and they blame others. And that might seem surprising to you, but abusers will oftentimes paint themselves as a victim. They're impulsive, they're aggressive, they're manipulative. They can be very, very gracious. If you're going to work with them every day, you might never suspect that they are abusing a spouse at home. They might be cordial and friendly, easy to get along with. They may do a great job when they're coaching your son at Little League. You might never suspect that this situation is going on at home. And they may be sitting in the pew next to you on Sunday, week after week, and you would never suspect that they are in an abusive situation. Oftentimes, they do have a past history of violence, and especially violence in a home where they grew up. So sometimes they've seen a pattern of violence that lets them believe that's a good way to control situations. They tend to be insensitive to others. They're incredibly self-focused, and they often make unrealistic demands on other people. It's part of their controls. They have great trouble communicating to solve problems, and they don't usually work. I'm sorry, thank you. I'm really bad at that. No, I'm glad you did, because I would just keep running right through this.
Are
do I need to be here? So they have trouble communicating with others to solve problems. And as a matter of fact, they usually don't work very hard at communicating to solve problems because they allow the violence to speak for them as a way to solve problems. They are often, as we mentioned, charming and gracious in public. And because of that, they sometimes can be kind of hidden from you. There are some cycles that you're going to see in dealing with these couples that you just might want to stay aware of. There's a tension building cycle with words and tone of voice, and the spouse will be very good at describing this for you. Now, this is kind of a pattern we see in the family, and we can tell that's a buildup. And then they'll be able to tell you about a battering stage where there's pushing and shoving, kind of the start of the physical abuse, and then sometimes it becomes much more violent than that. We'll progress onto a guilt stage where the abuser feels bad for what they did. And then they reach an apologizing stage where they say, "I feel bad for what I did. And I'm sorry," but you will not hear them asking for forgiveness. It's not a biblical sense of guilt where they see a need to change. They just want to be forgiven for this latest outburst of violence. And oftentimes you'll find that the spouse will be forgiving. And then you'll see that cycle just continue. And as I mentioned, this is a profile, and because it's a profile, it's not going to fit everyone, and not everybody who has some of these characteristics should you assume they're a batterer either. It is just a profile of what these people sometimes look like. We'll talk a little bit about the abused, and as I mentioned, that's usually the wife. And one of the things you're going to find is she loves her husband, and she hopes for change. She married this guy. She didn't see this in advance or didn't recognize it as a long-term pattern. And she loves him, and she wants this to work. She hopes for change. She has a very high view of marriage. She believes that you get married and you ought to stay married. And while a lot of people can't figure out why she hasn't left, it's because she views marriage as a very sacred thing, and she wants it to work. And she's working to make that happen. She just usually doesn't know how to do that. She's fearful. She's fearful for a lot of reasons. The first thing she's fearful about is that no one will believe her. Remember, this guy looks good. Out in public, this guy looks good. So she's terribly afraid that the pattern would normally be that if she's abused and if there are marks, then that close-knit family stays inside the house until she can be seen in public again, right? So oftentimes she is terribly afraid that if she would come to someone at church or anyone else and say, "Hey, my husband's abusing me," people would say, "Well, you know, are you sure you're not exaggerating?" They just simply might not believe her, and she really is worried about that. And sometimes she's fearful that if she tells, the situation will get worse. And you've all seen this in one television show or another where he says, "If you tell anybody, then I will really abuse you." And so what happens is these women are first afraid no one will believe them, and then they're afraid that if they bring it forward, it will get worse. So they're really locked in a cycle of fear. Sometimes they're very proud and they're deceptive. They'll go to extreme measures to conceal the problem. So they'll wear clothing that will cover the bruises on their arms, or they'll overdo makeup so that you can't see that black eye. They're afraid if it gets out, their reputation will be ruined. Hard to believe that you would think their reputations are at risk, but people will say, how could you be so stupid as to let this happen? Or what did you do that would cause him to react like that? Or why couldn't you make this marriage work? People are very fearful of their reputation. They're also afraid of his reputation being ruined. Remember, these are people who have a high view of marriage, who love their spouses, and they really don't want to ruin him. They just want this to stop. And they know once this becomes public, there's a good chance their husband's reputation will be ruined. Maybe his job, his career, his church life. And so they're very afraid to let it out because they don't want to ruin him. Oftentimes they're confused. They've heard for years that you're the from the spouse, you're the reason I've hit you. You're stupid. You're incompetent. And after you hear that for a long time, unless there's something else going on in your life that convince you that's not true, people start to believe that it is true. And this woman starts to believe that she is incompetent. If she was just a better wife, he wouldn't respond this way. And so that pattern continues within itself. Sometimes they're aggressive. Now you tend, when we talk about abused spouses, you tend to think of these as very submissive people who are just very quiet, meek, and fragile. And that really is not always the case. Let me see what we have here. I have a quote here from Neil Jacobson, who has a PhD from the University of Washington. And it is just, it is a secular view, and I'm going to tell you, it was published in Psychology Today, which is not normally a reference we use here, okay? But I want to give you this description of what sometimes even secular people see in an abused spouse. It says, the stereotype of a battered wife is fragile, passive, placating, docile, and self-depreciating, does not do justice to their actual role in the relationships. Women prove to be more functional members of these couples. What's more, during the confrontations, they reciprocate anger, and they contempt and anger and contempt, tit for tat, and they don't back down. They don't act as if they have a fear of being beaten later. But no matter what they try, once the violence starts, there's nothing they can do to stop it. The wives aren't beaten. The wives are beaten, but they're not beaten into submission. So the picture he paints is a battered spouse who hardens and gets harder and harder, and in doing that, in some ways, contributes to the problem. Now, that doesn't mean that that's okay. It doesn't mean that it excuses the abuse. It absolutely doesn't. There is no excuse for it. It is inexcusable behavior. But he is trying to point out that the picture of the abuser as always being this mild-mannered, doing nothing to contribute to the problem, really is not always an accurate picture. And we just want to let you know that. The seventh thing, is that they're also often financially dependent. One of the reasons they're not coming forward is because they're these people with very controlled lives, these women oftentimes don't have some way to support themselves if something happens to the relationship. And as we mentioned earlier, she's often afraid to ruin his reputation because that is the sole source of income to take care of that family. So another thing that contributes to hiding this is that financial dependency. In my own experience, I wouldn't attempt to paint a profile for you because I have seen it. I've seen spousal abuse in couples with almost no formal education and people with PhDs. I've seen it from people who go to church, and I've seen it from people who never go to church, who are just the opposite end of that spectrum. I've seen a few abusive wives and submissive husbands, but that really is very rare. And some of you have probably seen friends and families, and maybe yourself have been through some of this. And so you know that these profiles and these examples aren't universally true. So let's talk about counseling the abused spouse. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to define the problem biblically. You want to avoid psychological labels such as unhealthy marriage, dysfunctional family, low self-esteem, because those aren't things you're going to find in the Bible. Those aren't the problems we're really trying to address. So we're going to try to avoid those types of labels. We want to help people see that they are suffering for righteousness' sake. And if you have your Bibles, we can look at 1 Peter 3. Verse 17 says, it is better, if it is God's will, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. And verse 14 says, but even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear what they fear, and do not be frightened. So we want them to understand that the Bible has a lot to say to them. And we want to help them find those scriptures to do that. We also, however, want to remind them that you have to examine yourself to determine if you are suffering for righteousness' sake. And some of the things you can do that it will help people look at their own behavior in these relationships would be to keep log lists. So what do you think, when we're saying logs, what do you think we're talking about? Right? The log's in your own eye, right? So rather than just focus on their spouse, as you've seen in biblical counseling over and over, it focuses on you. It focuses on how you're behaving within that relationship or within that behavior. So we sometimes have to get people to keep log lists, to keep track of the things they're doing that they need to focus on rather than just what their spouse is doing. And sometimes you can also have them keep a journal of upsets. Have you had any? I think it was one of the tapes we looked at where he had them keep a journal of upsets, things that get them fired up, things that get rolling, start the arguments. So you might have the spouse keep a journal of upsets that will kind of give some indication of what, from her perception, gets these things to flare up. And again, the focus is not for her to accept responsibility for his behavior. We're not trying to excuse his behavior or explain his behavior. We're trying to help her live a more godly life herself, even within this bad relationship. Counselors should not shy away from helping these women change where necessary. We also want to... I'm going to have to appoint one of you to put your hand up when I forget to do these. We're going to teach her God's goal for her in this situation. And again, if we could look at our Bibles to Psalm 119. So verse 67 says, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I obey your word. And verse 71 says, it was good for me to be afflicted so that I might learn from your decrees. And the psalmist says in verse 75, I know, O Lord, that your laws are righteous, and in faithfulness you have afflicted me. So we want to help this person see that God does have his hand in this situation, and he can use that situation to help her become more Christ-like. That's kind of what we're looking at here. You should also help her see that she can exalt Christ in her suffering. And I'll let you look at Philippians 1:20 on your own. And you must magnify God through your suffering. And at the end of the time we spend together, we want people not to be talking about her. We want people to be talking about God. We want that focus to shift always. We're always trying to change from a man-centered view of problems to a God-centered view of problems. And we're always trying to do that in counseling, and it's really easy to lose that focus and get caught up in the minute with the problem and lose that whole view of God, which is bigger and which is where we have to be going. We have to help her see that she has to obey God no matter what the cost. And we'll look at Daniel 3. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God that we serve is able to save us from us, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. So what they were saying to the king was, we don't know how God's going to handle this situation. We know that he could resolve it in the way that we'd like, but we know that he's going to resolve it in a way that's right, and we trust God. And that is a very, very important message to be able to get to these spouses who are abused, these women usually, because they are fearful, and they have to know that God really is in charge. She has to know that she has to be willing to suffer for righteousness' sake. And we talked earlier about there are some things we can do to help her make sure that it is for righteousness' sake. And we need to change to exalt Christ, not to change the husband. And as I mentioned earlier, and as you've seen week after week, biblical counseling is not about changing your partner or changing the other person. It is about how you are responding to God. And so we're not interested in this particular place in just changing the husband. We're also looking at how she is responding. And that is not a popular political approach. Okay? If you went to a secular counselor, it is all about her and changing his behavior. And we are really looking at both here. But we clearly are not excusing the behavior, and it is not okay. And we're not saying that it should continue. But her focus has to be what she can change. And the only thing we can change with God's help is ourselves, not other people. And finally, we have to teach her to pray for the abuser. So we've all been taught we have to pray for our enemies. Certainly somebody who's abusing you would qualify as an enemy. And most of us don't find that to be the easiest command, to pray for our enemies. We're still very self-protective. And so she is certainly not going to say, great. I suspect that most of these women pray for their spouses. They pray that he'll quit. They pray that he won't find a way home. But they don't really pray for him. And that's what we have to help them do, is pray for him. There are some resources that the wife can utilize. She can utilize biblical submissiveness. And we'll look at 1 Peter, if you have your Bibles. First Peter 2. Especially verse 3. As a matter of fact, we're going to go to chapter 3, verse 1 through 6. He says, wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of the wives, when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Your beauty should not come from an outward adornment, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way the holy women of the past, who put their hope in God, used to make themselves beautiful. They were submissive to their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. You are her daughters if you wish to do what is right and do not give way to fear. Now, again, we remind you that submissiveness, from a biblical standpoint, means that you are under the authority of somebody else only as long as that authority is not contradictory to God's laws and God's commands. So we expect her to be submissive in those parts of the relationship where the husband is in keeping with what God teaches. And we also want to remind her of the example of submissiveness. The best example of submissiveness is Christ, who, submissive to his Father's will, gave up a place in heaven and came down and took on human form. And suffered the worst sufferings that we can imagine as humans, including exposure to all the sin and temptation around him. So that's the model of submissiveness, and you can work with the women who are struggling to see it from that perspective. Wives are also not to retaliate with their tongues. Again, we want them to try, and submissiveness is a model of not being under the thumb, but it's an act of relinquishing that control. So we want her to be able to do that. It runs directly counter to what people or women are being taught today, even by Christian counselors. They're being taught they got to stand up for themselves, they got to be tough, they have to do whatever it takes to stop him. And we want him to stop, but we want her to do that in a God-honoring way and follow the commands in the Scripture. We want her to remember that her husband's disobedience does not mean that she also can disobey. Next, we want to utilize biblical communication. I'm going to turn to Proverbs. But surely I said them all. Tell me what we're missing.
Be
well. I'm going to work on biblical communication. Proverbs 12:6 says, "The words of the wicked lie in wait for blood, but the speech of the upright rescues them." And there are a number of other references that you could use. But we want to focus on getting this couple to communicate using biblical communication patterns. We want to utilize God's battle plan for overcoming evil. And you're all familiar with that. God doesn't say beat your enemy up, right? What does God say? He says that you're going to pray for them and that you're going to pour hot oil on them and prayer and grace to them. You're going to change them with grace. And that's exactly what we're going to try and teach people to do in these sessions. We're also going to utilize church discipline. God has given us this dynamic to reconcile believers and to winnow out those who may have made a false profession. And this is a powerful tool that we are required to use. And some of you, some of the churches struggle with a willingness to use this, but remember, biblical discipline is not designed to shun people and put them outside. It is designed to kind of, if you will, to shake them and get their attention to what they're losing and what they're missing, and get them to come back to the church. So there's a number of steps, starting with confronting them directly. Bringing others with you, bringing it to the church elders, and then a period of confrontation with the church, and then putting people outside the church so that they feel that loss in return. So we want to use church discipline when necessary to resolve some of these problems. You also want to use governing authorities. So again, We are not preaching. We are not telling people that spousal abuse is okay, that it can just continue. We'll keep praying and hope everything's okay. There are government authorities that will respond and will help keep the abused spouse safe. And we are required to use those. And Romans 13, 1 through 6 kind of helps you see that we're not suggesting you don't use anything outside the church. We just think that to resolve the real heart issues and the problems, we want to try using biblical approaches. But if you need, for safety reasons, to use government authority, you need to do that and protect people. We also want to remember the promises of God. The trials are intended to change you, okay? And sometimes we struggle to remember that. And you can find that in Romans 8, 28 and 29, or Romans 5, 3 to 5. That neither you nor the children will suffer irreparable harm if you are zealous for good. Now, we need to define zealous for good is for God's will, and that irreparable harm we won't suffer irreparable harm, so other people's actions aren't going to cause us to lose our eternal salvation. That doesn't say that bad things won't happen, but they are bad things from an earthly viewpoint. And this is where most women want the most protection. We want to remember that it's not physical all the time. We want to remember there's a context to all of this. We want to help people grow, and we want to help people become more godlike within themselves and within their marriage. One of the things you're going to struggle against is that the worldly context is going to be to break the cycle of violence by leaving or getting a divorce. And we're not proposing that that's the way you fix this problem. We're proposing we fix this problem biblically by working on her issues and his issues and communication issues, and that we allow God to make those changes in people. God has promised great rewards, and we want to allow him to deliver on that promise. Counseling the abuser. Again, we want to define the problem biblically. We want to avoid psychological labels. We want to avoid allowing him to say he doesn't mean to do this, but he's bipolar. He doesn't mean to do this except he has a drinking problem. We want to avoid allowing people to put this into secular psychological labels. We want them to see that he is assuming God's place. God alone is the absolute power and is not delegated to this husband. He is not the absolute power over his family. God is that absolute power. And we want to point out to him that he is taking on God's role when he takes on the power absolutely over his family. We want him to see that he is misusing his God-given authority to control. So he starts to believe that it's his family to use the way he wants, that it allows him to be the king of the hill. And we just want to remind him that it's God's given authority, and it's given very, very specifically, and he's abusing it. So again, we're trying to help him see the sin in his behavior. We want to help him see that he's playing God by trying to take revenge. Look at Romans 12, 19. It says, "Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, 'It is mine to avenge. I will repay,' says the Lord." On the contrary, this guy tends to take it into his own hands, and he takes revenge out on his family. We want him to see the sin in that behavior. We want him to see that he's obscuring the glory of God. And you can see a reference for that in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 51. He is rejecting the example of Christ. Again, we want to base our marital relationships. We want to be husbands like Christ took the church and acted as a husband to the church. And clearly, this is not the model. So he's rejecting that example by Christ. He's teaching rebellion by example. He fails to submit, but he wants his wife to submit. He doesn't submit to God's authority, but then he wants her to submit to his authority. And he's going to have that same problem with his children, too. He's teaching them not to submit because the motto is that he's not going to submit to God's authority. We also want him to see that his sinful behavior is because he is plundering the helpless. In Proverbs, in the Old Testament, God has made it very clear that we're to take care of the helpless, not to plunder them, take advantage of them. We want him to see that he is evading loving, learning, forgiving, leading. He's evading communication, development of gifts of family, and gratefulness in his effort to be in control and to be king of the hill. And we want to help him see that the predominant idol here of abuse, that idol of the heart for abuse, is control. That he doesn't allow God to be in control. He has to be in control. And he exhibits that in his family. We want to help him see that. We also want him to know that God has a goal for him in this situation. So, one guy might say, "Pastor, you'd hit her too if you lived with her." Or one guy says, "There's no pleasing that woman." And we're going to help him understand that all of us have things in our lives. And if God has given him this woman, and if he is accurately reflecting her behavior, God has put that woman in his life for a reason. And for the same reason each of us have things in our lives, that's to help us to become more Christ-like. So even if his perception of how she behaves is accurate, his response to that is inappropriate. And we want to help him see that. That God puts people into our lives to help us become more like Christ. And that you are responsible for your own actions. You are responsible for your actions. That God is not going to ask him, what about your wife's behavior? God's going to ask him about his own behavior, and he is responsible for that behavior. Did I go too fast? That was a good ups. We cut up. Sorry about that. So we have counseling goals for the abuser. And these are the things that he needs to learn and to do. An area of growth for him. He must learn to repent, and he must learn to accept responsibility. Blame shifting is a major problem for abusers. As I mentioned earlier, they paint themselves as victims, and we want to help them understand that they have to learn to accept responsibility for their behavior. The counselor has to constantly confront, call to repentance, and always let him know that he is responsible for his actions. No matter how he tries to shift that responsibility to other people, the counselor has to continually bring him back to his responsibility for his behaviors. He must learn servant leadership. His position is that his family exists to serve him. And in our society, it's tough to teach people servant leadership. It is not a model that has really broad acceptance in our society. And we have to help him learn that his model for leadership is Christ. And that's servant leadership. And we have to help him find ways to do that. He must learn biblical love. Look at Ephesians. Ephesians 25 says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without blemish, stain, wrinkle, or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. If we want him to recognize, biblical love requires him to model what he has seen from Christ. And we want, and we have to work with him on that constantly. He must learn his wife first. He can't love his wife until he learns her. So rather than him being the focus of everything in that relationship, he's going to have to change his focus and learn who she is and what her needs are and how he can help her grow. You can find a reference for that in 1 Peter 3, verse 7. And he has to learn to communicate to solve problems. We said earlier that this man has a tendency to let violence do all of his communicating for him in that relationship. We have to teach him more effective communication skills. And you've talked about those in a number of sessions already. We need to help him learn those communication skills. And finally, as in almost all the counseling that we work on, he has to get to the heart issues and the heart issues and desires that cause his behavior. And he tends to say, I must have control, I must be king of the hill, I must be served by all, and I must have the respect of everyone. And those are the desires that drive him. The heart issue is really control for him. We have to work at letting him see how God needs to be in control of his life, not him in control of his life. And that would then allow the family to be driven by God being in control rather than this man trying to take over control for God. And you can help him get to that by using a journal of upsets. Or Lou Prioli has a heart journal, which really helps people get to the heart issues behind that behavior. And so both of those things will be helpful for this man. I'm sorry? I couldn't hear what you said. You got it? Okay, I'm sorry. He also must be held accountable. You can find this in Matthew, you can find this in Galatians, Hebrews 13:17. There's a number of references that talk about him being accountable. You have to take him back to the Bible and help him see that. You have to help him see that he is accountable to the church. The church has to give him enough love to hold him accountable through church discipline, if that's what it takes. We have to be able to really hold him accountable. He has to be accountable to the counselor. He must agree that anytime his wife feels threatened, she can pick up the phone and call immediately. Doesn't have to be because he has moved that cycle into violence. If she feels threatened, you have to agree to that. He has to agree to that. He has to be accountable to you. If his wife feels threatened, she can call immediately. Program it right into the phones. Almost everybody has a button now. She doesn't have to scramble for numbers. She pushes that button if she's feeling threatened. And if that becomes an issue where you have to work with her around helping her control when she feels fearful, then you work with her and her side of the counseling. But to hold him accountable, he has to know that she's going to call if she feels threatened. And if he doesn't agree to this in counseling, then you might have to look at working harder at the church discipline side to bring him back into that. And he has to be accountable to the police, to government authorities if necessary. And we would hope that we don't have to get to that place, but we might. We want to get the church involved. We want to make sure we don't fail to hear her about her problems and about her fears and about how threatened she feels and about the need for the family to come around her, the church family. We want to assure her that God is on the side of the helpless and that the world needs to see the church is indeed on the side of women. One of the things that happens One of the ways we're painted far too often in public is that submission would mean that we would accept this. And we have to make sure that our behavior demonstrates to people that we are holding him accountable, and that this is not anybody's view of biblical submission, that we do not find this acceptable. We have to get her protection. We have to help her do the things that are necessary to protect herself. It might be she might have to get verification of the bruises. If he's beating her up and they're hiding that, women in the church may have to help her find a way to get verification, to see a doctor, to do whatever it takes to have that evidence that she might need to get protection from the police if necessary. And we also might have to find people in our church who could be used as safe houses when she needs protection. Now, this is pretty scary stuff. You got this guy who's an abuser, and he's violent, and he's scary. And now I'm going to tell you to have her come to your house, right? So this is where the rubber meets the road. But if the church is really going to deliver for these people, we have to step up and do that. And we have to use the same wisdom that they would use. They don't have a sign out front that says safe house, right? Nobody advertises where their safe house is. So if they're somewhere in the church where she's going to go when she has to be safe, you don't want to discuss that place in your counseling session so he knows where to go to find her, right? He knows where to find the counselor. So if she's in a safe place, he knows where he has to go. He has to come back to the counselor to find you, to move that process along. But the church will have to step up and do that. Different from what oftentimes happens in a secular setting is separation we would see as being a very short-term intervention, maybe even in hours, enough to de-escalate that situation and then try and get this couple working together again. You want to get it cooled. You want to get this cooled down, and then you want to meet back in the pastor's office. So the church becomes the place of authority that gives her some sense of safety and protection. Now, we know that comes from God, but we need an earthly place for her to feel that too. And the church is the appropriate place to do that. So that means when he cools down, you don't invite him to the safe house, right? when he cools down enough for us to meet, we're going to do that in the church, hopefully with the pastor present. All right, that's the way we want that to work. When exercise discipline faithfully, when I follow Matthew 18, in any church that fails to follow through on church discipline will have trouble holding their members accountable in a lot of areas. So if this is a place where your church struggles, this won't be the only place where you'll struggle. So we all need to be faithful to Matthew 18. Getting the church involved helps the abused spouse see that the church is vitally concerned for her and for the children. It helps the children because it shows them that their father's authority is not absolute, that God is the absolute authority, not this man who has been terrorizing their family. Now we have to help them recognize the authority that is legitimate, that he does get from God. It helps the abuser because he understands that he is expected to change. He's not going to come in here and shift the blame to the rest of the family. He sees there are consequences, and it may be the element that finally prods him to godliness. The fact that he's now going to be held accountable and that there are consequences to that behavior. Many people today would talk about breaking the cycle of violence, And we would like to break the cycle of violence too. We would just like to approach the sin problem and approach it from a way that offers real hope. We don't want to just break the violence. As with all the other things you've learned in biblical counseling, we don't want to stop sin. We want to get good, healthy, Christ-like behavior. And so that's what we're really looking for. There is real hope in this. We have hope that through the regenerating and sanctifying power of God the Spirit, these people can really change their lives. We believe that they can find answers through God's all-sufficient word. We believe they can change their behavior through repentance and change through the Spirit moving them and through following the word. We believe they can find that there is a church that loves them enough to discipline them and to embrace them, and that they need that to grow. And through shepherds who will not run from these problems, but who will love and care for the sheep God has entrusted to their care, we can make real changes in these people's lives. And I'm sorry I ran a little bit over. This is a long session, and I had to keep going back to move those slides. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, we'll try for them. You're probably worried that track 3 has already got all the